Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So what is it, what isn't it, I should say, that the D.C. press corps, the left, what is it they don't politicize? A natural disaster? No, of course not. We've been here before. We've been here before. Every hurricane, if you can't, or major weather event, if you can't pin it on a Republican politician, then you just make an appeal to global climate change and you pin it on the Republican Party writ large because they're not doing enough to end Western civilization like the neo-Luddites on the left. So here you have a real opportunity with Hurricane Ian. Mm-hmm. By the way, is that racist? Aren't we supposed to balance the names of natural disasters with names that are ethnic, not like honky names like Ian?
Wasn't that a thing? There has been a Hurricane Daniel.
Yeah, but that's a thing. Wait, they complain about the name choices, right, that they're all like Eurocentric, and there needs to be more diversity in name selections for natural disasters.
And now,
such an honor to be named after a natural disaster.
And speaking of names, now they're thinking about naming heat waves, just as they do hurricanes.
Of course, because that's a disaster brought on by Republicans in action,
exactly,
on climate change.
So we need to name it. We need to make it real.
But with respect to Hurricane Ian, boy, what an opportunity for the press corps to see if they can pin this on DeSantis like they pinned Katrina on George W. Bush, right? We've been here before. And so the press briefing by FEMA Administrator Deanna Criswell yesterday featured these sorts of questions from the D.C. press corps. It doesn't even matter. It doesn't even matter the names you'll hear from different reporters at the White House press briefing. The names don't matter because they're sharing a brain. Who cares what their names are? They're all the same.
Can you describe just the level of communication with state officials, and have there been anything unusual or any challenges with that? How would you describe it?
Yeah, I think the communication that we have had with the state officials has been excellent. My regional administrator out of Region 4, Gracia Check, she is in Florida. She got there yesterday. She has been embedded at the state EOC working with the state emergency management director one-on-one to make sure we're understanding what their needs are. And she's traveling with the governor to a few areas today to make sure we're understanding what those needs. We've had a long relationship with Florida. Our Region 4 has had a great partnership with all of the emergency management team there. They've done a lot of work with the different municipalities and the counties, and I think the relationship is very strong.
Uh-oh, she wasn't supposed to say that.
Right, so you think, well, that's the end
fight.
Of it. What's the big deal, Dan? That's the end of it. They asked a question about state-federal communications, and she answered it, and that's the end of it. But it isn't the end of it. Because apparently she didn't hear the question. Now give us the answer that we want.
In the past, President Biden, has made calls to governors in situations of natural disasters. KIV in Alabama, or Asa Hutchinson in Arkansas, or the governor in Texas. Can you articulate, I guess, how those determinations are made and why it hasn't been made in this case to have the president call the governor?
Yeah, the president is very focused on making sure that the federal family has the right resources available to support this. That is why I contacted the governor right away, and we have a team of my senior leadership that are embedded with the governor to make sure that we're supporting that. Our focus today is making sure that we have the right measures in place to support the life-saving activities that need to happen. Any conversations afterwards, we need to see what the damages are.
Administrator Criswell, Let's try this again.
But he's made conversations with the mayors. So is there any reason why not the governor?
Again, we have a strong team that's in place supporting the governor right now, working side by side with him and his staff. We'll continue to stay engaged with him.
For
the seventh time.
We'll go as long as we need to go until we get the answer that we want. You're not going to wear us down.
Just a follow-up to that. Normally, presidents call governors, or the governors call presidents. But the only thing that really, during hurricanes, the only real question I really want to answer is it in any way the fact that they haven't talked? Is there any way that it's impeded efforts for the federal government or FEMA to implement plans in Florida? And if so, what would they be?
Now, this is that we are very focused on what the needs of Florida is right now.
Right. The federal family.
We do not bring politics into our ability to respond to these disasters. We are going to support whatever Governor DeSantis asks of us. We signed his emergency declaration within hours of him sending it in. We'll continue to do that as we see what the impacts of the storm are.
So the communication between the president and the governor has no impact on how you all operate?
Zero.
That is just exhausting. Wow. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, it's just such a wonderful illustration of the D.C. press corps in advance of the whatever damage Hurricane Ian is going to wreak on the state of Florida.
Here, it's going to be deadly.
Well, I mean,
everyone keeps saying it's going to be deadly.
We don't know. I'm in touch with some friends down in Southwest Florida, and it was, raining and windy there. But of course, today is supposed to be the day, according to the, weather experts.
Man, Sean told me he's going to grab a cigar and a boat and go ahead, head out in the eye of it.
Yeah.
Have you ever been through a hurricane before, Sean? No. Okay, Sean, I take it a little more serious.
Sean from Elmwood Park.
Sean. Yeah, Sean.
Yeah. So
we're family.
That's like the federal family. This is the AM560 family.
Yeah.
And so Sean is very much fabulous, like Joe Biden. Remember how Joe Biden stood on the Eastern Seaboard and he said to Ebola, you shall not pass. And that's why we didn't have an Ebola outbreak in the United States. Remember? So Sean's going to do that. You shall not hurt my condo building.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And hopefully he'll also
go over
to my place and
check your place out.
And then go to old Florida, my club, which I'm most concerned about.
Oh, really?
The golf club. I don't want the golf club negatively impacted.
Right.
I'd probably play in this.
See, you would too.
I mean, 125 mile an hour winds. I'd probably play. Because it's the only.
Because
he'll
take your ball.
I think to myself, what would Ben Hogan do? And, the only way you learn to shape shots is to play in inclement weather.
Okay.
So that's what I'm
sure
mainly thinking
about. I'm sure he had
hurricanes
in mind.
Yeah. Mark on the south side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It was reported last night that Biden did end up calling DeSantis. I think I've seen it on Newsmax.
Oh, yeah. Is that right? I mean, the whole point about that is, who the hell cares? I mean, what is Joe Biden going to tell Ron DeSantis that he doesn't already know, that he can't get from like the actual disaster relief agency, FEMA, and the administrators and the staff there, and the staff's talking and so forth? Like, there has to be a big summit where Joe Biden is going to impart some wisdom on to Ron DeSantis. Yeah, I don't need to talk to you, Mr. 10%. You're the administrative staff. This is what we have these agencies for, even though most of them shouldn't exist. But this is what you have FEMA for. So to the extent they're going to play a role and there's federal resources to activate and marshal on behalf of Floridians or anybody else impacted by this hurricane, just like in any other natural disaster, great. So have people that are implementation people on the ground talk. We don't need, did you call? What was the conversation like?
How long did it last?
Is it political? Are you mad? Are you giving somebody the silent treatment? No. Who cares? It's so kindergarten. I mean,
oh my God, who
thank
the
you.
Hell cares?
Exactly. Larry in Elmhurst.
Hey, good morning. Hey, how big of a hurricane does it have to be to be called JB?
I think it's got to get to a Category 5. Yeah, thanks for the call.
Well, Governor DeSantis has done a great job communicating with his people.
When you have 5 to 10 feet of storm surge, that is not something that you want to be a part of. And Mother Nature is a very fearsome adversary.
Sean.
Sean. You know, the county, at the county and local level, it's where all the action is. I got a text yesterday for evacuation in Collier County.
Yeah.
For a particular zone. You know, they've zoned it in these counties and communities. And so, you know, you need to evacuate if you're, which I'm not in zone one, my house isn't. But anyway, regardless, that's where the action is. It's not a conversation between Joe Biden and Ron DeSantis that this all turns on. It's just inanity. Total inanity. And with respect to DeSantis, for as much as they want him to fail, which is just a bizarre posture to take.
Yeah, they want people to die. They want people to fail. Him to fail.
DeSantis, I mean, the strength of DeSantis, and I assume we'll see it here, is that he's hands-on. As I've said from the beginning, one of the reasons he's rose to such prominence is because he is so engaged at the executive level that he has granular knowledge of what's going on, which is why he makes arguments and explains things, why we did this, why we're doing that, in a way that most politicians don't.
Yeah, and he's going to stay there, too. He's not going to, you know, flee or move to Tennessee temporarily while this happens.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't expect he would. I mean, somebody has to guard the Pritzker compound in Wellington, make sure that isn't negatively impacted.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Flash Mobile. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, turning our attention to the Great Disintegration, as I call it, the disintegration of America's urban centers at the hands of Democrat socialist politicians. The generational weight is finally forcing these cities to give way, isn't it? Which is why I found this report in the Wall Street Journal interesting. Some black Chicagoans hit by crime consider skipping midterm elections. Giving up. Reporters talked to some of our friends, including Pastor Corey Brooks, but just residents of the Austin neighborhood. They write, black Chicagoans say they are skeptical Chicago's violent crime problem will be addressed based on votes they cast this fall or next year when Lori Lightfoot's up for re-election. Some said their frustration with what they described as Democrats' lack of support for business development and other economic initiatives has left them disillusioned with the political process. For example, Anthony Young, 26-year-old black man, quoting him, neither politician, Republican or Democrat, represents the interests of black people. So he's not planning on voting in this election. I hope he does. I hope he changes his mind. If he's paying enough attention to know who isn't serving him, then he's paying enough attention to participate. Did you hear that? I'm not for voter suppression.
Are you sure?
Yeah. No, I want him to vote. I want Aunt Mr. Young to vote, and I want everybody who is engaged to vote. And if you're frustrated, that makes even it more important to assess and maybe reassess. Reporters find him on a recent summer day standing on a street corner talking to a longtime resident. He's only 26, Anthony Young. Longtime resident of the Austin neighborhood, Ronald Talley. He feels disillusioned with the political system. voted for Democrats in the past, but now he wondered whether voting was worth it. Crime is right here, he said, pointing to vacant blocks, no businesses. Main drag in Austin leads into the more affluent Oak Park neighborhood. Sure does. The tree-lined streets of the bordering suburb mark a clear boundary with Austin streets, which are barren in some parts. In certain blocks in and around Austin, roughly 40% of residents have incomes below the poverty line. That's 3.5 times the state average, or 3.5 times the state number, I should say. The population in some parts of Austin fell 6% between 2010 and 2020. Well, that's the hollowing out of the west and south sides that we've talked about quite a bit. Mr. Talley, politicians are not going to do it. Joe Biden, he ain't going to do it. What's the governor's name? Talley asks young J.B. Pritzker. He ain't going to do it. What's the mayor's name? Lori Lightfoot. She ain't going to do it. Mr. Talley moved on to the local alderman before concluding that none of them were going to change the area. I'm so disappointed. It's just like I'm throwing my vote away. Well, I suppose you are throwing your vote away if you continue to support the same people. I mean, the people that have the same policy perspective and they do the same things they've been doing for 50 years. And you expect that somehow finally the personality of someone or the skin color of someone will make a difference if they're making the same policy choices. Speaking of frustration, it's really frustrating that people who understand the failures and who's responsible for the failures and are abandoning the people in power, rightly so, won't take a flyer on the alternative. Because why? Because Donald Trump endorsed Darren Bailey? That's literally the answer that one of the guys they interviewed said.
Really?
I'm not voting for Pritzker. I can't vote for Bailey because Trump endorsed him. This idea, and it's like a psychosis the Democrats have inflicted on minority populations, particularly black families. Well, they failed us, the people we've been voting for. But I can't go to the other side, you know, because they're all white supremacists. I mean, do you really believe that?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Yeah, you look around. I mean, when people look around, I'd like to crawl into their mind. What do you actually see? I mean, do you see Klan rallies? Do you see people that are looking to institute Jim Crow in Illinois or Chicago? So what is it you're afraid of? That it can get worse? I cannot understand what people are seeing when they properly see the failures and then they look at the alternative and they say, well, we can't do that. We can't try that. We can't try the one thing that we've refused to try. We've tried everything else and everyone else on this side. And even maybe some soft Republicans, you know, Republicans in name only, that essentially were slow walking the policies of the left, the Jim Edgar type Republican, big government Republicans, all have failed. So conservative reform, which has the basis of the policy choices in the by political leaders in the states that are exploding with growth. You don't want to try that? That's a bridge too far. That's some sort of ruse to enslave you or something. I mean, what is the mentality? School choice? It seems like the families, disproportionately minority, disproportionately low income, that are accessing the Illinois Opportunities Scholarship Program, the tax credits, to send their kids to better schools. It seems like they didn't fall into some trap set by the white man. Their kids are in better schools, and they're happier because of it. So that's a conservative reform idea. That was, you know, Milton Friedman 60 years ago. It was Tommy Thompson and Polly Williams, a black Democrat Milwaukee city council member, that really brought it to the Midwest in the early 90s. You haven't been watching all of this? You think sticking to the CPS plantation is the better play? I want people to participate, but I'm not going to pander. That's what the left does. I'm not going to infantilize. That's what the left does. What the hell is wrong? What the hell is wrong with people?
Well, and they forget, too, that, you know, when Biden was running against Trump, Biden said, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or for Trump, then you ain't black.
No, right. Of course.
Remember that?
All the stuff.
Little Diddy,
Mitt Romney's going to put you back in chains. Does anybody really believe that Mitt Romney is a modern day slave master? Of course you didn't. But you let Joe Biden and Barack Obama get away with it anyway. You ain't black if you don't vote for me. Who gets away with saying that? Joe Biden does.
Yeah, it's insulting.
In addition to having your personal safety compromised, and I mean existentially compromised in some of these neighborhoods like Austin, while you look down the road in Oak Park and things are hunky-dory, or at least more hunky-dory, aren't they? In addition to having your economic opportunities lessened, to be generous, I mean, you know, these people see the neighborhoods. I'm not telling them anything they don't know. It's exactly right. You're being insulted and infantilized, but I can't leave these people. How? Why?
And they should love Trump because under his leadership, I mean, economic progress lifted the median black household income to their highest levels on record.
TJ Grooms, an associate pastor at New Beginnings Church, he met Darren Bailey during his travels on the campaign trail. But he planned to vote for Democrats because they're the lesser two evils. I don't really see the Democratic Party as a job generator. There's no programming that can essentially say, here's a job, here's some money that goes toward trades in the black community, here's training for electric plumbing, all those different kind of things. I don't really see the Democratic Party as a job generator, something good for my community, but I'm going to vote for him anyway. Why? Explain it. So you and by the way, especially this choice here, you identify lower and middle income people struggling to make it. You identify with some effete, silver spooned billionaire more than you do with a farmer. What's a farmer? It's just like a working guy, works with his hands. What's a family farmer? It's a middle income family, as you see from his tax returns. So, but I remember decrying the billionaire, you know, and I don't even think he was, but they made him one anyway. Bruce Rauner, he's obviously very wealthy. You know, these billionaires and that billionaire is on the right.
You have a bigger billionaire on the left.
You identify with you in Austin, identify with J.B. Pritzker. Are you kidding?
Nobody can identify with him. When was the last time he pumped gas? It was at the grocery store. Felt real people's pain.
I mean, he gets the struggle. He's down with the struggle, right? On the South and West sides.
Because he goes to parades and dances with Juliana Stratton.
This is laughable. And frankly, these storefront or not storefront ministers that are paid, bought and paid for, they're a joke. They're a disgrace. Is that racist to say? The hell with it. The hell with your racist cover story. It's a bunch of nonsense. Brian Alexander, who's an aide to Cory Brooks, he had a political awakening this year. He'd been a straight ticket Democrat voter, worked for Democrat politicians. That belief, he said his belief he could never sort any Republican change when he returned from living elsewhere and saw his childhood neighborhood of Inglewood had stagnated. Stagnated, that's a generous description. He blames Democrat policies that, in his view, made residents dependent on public aid. Yeah, no kidding. Welcome to the awakening. As much as I thought being on the left, they're the bad guys and we're the good guys, I realize you need competition within the market. Right now in Chicago, there's no competition in the political market, so the consumer is suffering. Exactly. Very insightful Econ 101 analysis. And yet, he plans to vote for Mr. Pritzker despite his misgivings because Bailey accepted Trump's endorsement.
Oh, another one? Come on.
Are you out of your mind? Do you even listen to what, I mean, for this guy, do you even listen to what you're saying? How does that logically follow? What's going to happen? Is Putin going to take over Illinois too? It's just, it's astounding. You want to talk about frustrating. You want to, and I've said this to some of my friends in the black community. You know, we talk about other stuff. Oh, you want to talk about your frustrations? Let me tell you my frustrations. Let me tell you my frustrations with this sort of thinking. It is evidence-free. It is fantastical. It has no basis in reality. It is self-destructive. What the hell is wrong with you, Mr. Alexander? Come on. I want you to participate. I want you to vote. Even if you vote for Pritzker. I don't care who you vote for. I want you engaged. But I want you to at least, and you, Alexander, everyone, at least be man enough to step up and have to defend yourself. Defend this sort of thinking. Make the argument. So ridiculous. Oh, am I supposed to cater? Is that what we're supposed to do? We're supposed to come with alms? The hell with that. Man up. Matt in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. A little bit of hope. Living in the city, I speak to people on a regular basis, on a one-on-one basis, and having a conversation saying, hey, what have they done for you in your life, for your mother and father's life, forever? Nothing. The answer is nothing. And you stop, ask the question, and make them think about it. And I've had some really, really good conversations. Now, many, many people have been indoctrinated with the leftist beliefs. However, when you challenge them to think, it's almost like the light bulb goes off. You see what's happening within their heads. Guy asked me, hey, what do you think about JB? I said, don't ask me. But the point of the story is that you have a one-on-one conversation with individual people. It's like eating an elephant one bite at a time. And you educate them because there's so much ignorance out there. And you help educate the ignorant and you forget about the stupid because you cannot fix stupid.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Matt. I mean, I wish, because I do, chance more people. Is that what you aspire to be? You aspire to be some North Shore panty waist, or are you going to be a man? If things are going to turn around in black neighborhoods for black families, then you're going to have men step up and be men. So you're going to be a man, or are you going to be some public aid dependent? To the point that Mr. Alexander Corey Brooks's aide made, that he sees what's happening, and yet he's going to continue supporting the plantation owner. Huh? It can be men or not. I mean, it's the same question I ask of these ghastly pea hats run by their wives in Hinsdale and Naperville, those honkies. Why can't I put that same question to young black men in particular, or old black men? There's always time to change. There's always time to wake up. It's never too late to be enlightened. It's never too late to take productive risks. Get outside your political comfort zone. Bob, Edison Park.
Yeah, guys, my observation, and I'm the truth be told, I think it's generational because I happen to be the black people I talk to, the young males, the young black males, working class. Let me tell you something. They are conservative to a large degree. It's the older generation that tend to be lockstep with the Democrat Party. And this, obviously it's not a scientific study, but I'm calling a radio show. I'm pretty politically involved as much as I can be. So I do talk to people. But I tell everybody, I am amazed at the conservative-leaning sort of young black males. They're like of Trump. I mean, how many of them have told me that they want Trump back, they even voted for him the second time? I'm telling you, it's generational. And take a look at it yourself. The younger black males, working class, they are basically coming to the fold.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Glen, Oak Park.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call. There's a famous Jewish person. I think his name is Elie Wiesel.
And yeah, Nobel Prize winner, wrote The Night, Holocaust survivor, yes.
He talked about being neutral, and he said being neutral supports the oppressors. You cannot be neutral. You have to take a stand.
Absolutely.
And you have to be courageous, and you have to do it not just for yourself, but for the next generation, the kids, and the next generation of people to have a better life. So don't be neutral. Read Elie Wiesel.
Thanks for the call, Glenn.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Harris Faulkner is a Fox News host during the days, you know.
Oh, yeah. I watch her often. I like her.
She's pretty good. She went down to Eagle Pass, Texas.
Oh, finally. Yes.
Yeah, went down to Eagle Pass. Some enterprising reporter go down to actually see what's happening, and here's what she found.
People come. They change out of their wet garments. They leave. And I mean, when I tell you there's personal stuff here, I mean personal feminine hygiene products, everything all over the ground. It's unbelievable how easy it is to cross that river. This gate is wide open right now because we don't have enough people. So many people have come across today. There's no Border Patrol. There's no National Guard at this point. This is humanity that's coming across a river point into Eagle Pass, Texas. And the citizens here are our first line of defensive information about it. People spend a lot of money on alarm systems for their houses. But for some reason, Washington can't hear the voices of the people in Eagle Pass. And their alarm is for free.
Noah Silva is the manager of Burr Ranch in Eagle Pass, which is right on the border. And here's what he described as happening in this conversation with Harris Faulkner.
It's 100,000 acres with miles of perimeter chain that the owner has put up over and over. People's dreams, livelihoods, and homesteads are under threat.
When I got here almost 6 years ago in November, I didn't see any illegals. Every now and then I might see one or two together. That was it. Now it's... It started from 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, and it went up and up and up. Now, those are the ones that were caught. How many made it all the way through? It's hard to say.
Is it daytime, nighttime?
24/7. It's 24/7.
And the report earlier this week from John Solomon's group, Just the News, that the Biden administration is quietly, I'll use the Biden sotto voce to emphasize what they're doing. They're restarting some border wall construction that was suspended, that was started by the Trump administration, suspended when he came in because you had to do the big performative suspension, end of Trump's bad old policies of border security, and now they're quietly restarting,
And that the construction material has been laying right next to it this entire time for almost 2 years.
Correct. That's correct.
Some of it they sold off and lost money on, but And in, you know what they're doing in New York? They're building a tent city for these migrants.
In the Bronx.
In the Bronx, yes, in AOC's congressional district, by the way. So you have to walk through that. It's housing, heated tents to house 1,000 adults for as many as 4 days or longer while they undergo screening before entering the city's shelter system.
Yeah, Eric Adams, the mayor there, all of a sudden recognizes this is a national problem. We must have a national solution to this problem. We can't just say, let's turn our backs on New York City. That comes with coordinating with all of our country with this issue. Oh, really? I'm frustrated with the fact this is a national issue that must be resolved, said New York City Mayor Eric Adams, who proudly presides over a sanctuary city. He's requested $500 million in emergency funding that we're supposed to provide to New York City, the sanctuary city. And you can be sure that Chicago will be right behind. We requested money to deal with the crisis. That's what we did, and it's what we're going to continue to do. This is expensive, and we should not have to trade off dealing with the needs of New Yorkers and dealing with the needs of migrants and asylum seekers. Right.
Oh, just put the burden on El Paso and Eagle Pass in Texas.
Well, not only that, you may want to consider how expensive things are when you decide to make policy choices. Oh, there are costs to my policy choices. Wow, what a surprise. Keisha Lance Bottom has been making the rounds a little bit more frequently lately, saying all kinds of loony things. She's a former mayor of Atlanta that essentially got run out of Atlanta because she let her city descend into lawlessness. She's now an advisor to the president. Of course she is. Keisha Lance Bottom's on what's going on at the border and what the grand strategy is, because, of course, they got a plan. Of course, they have a strategy. We're talking about the Biden administration. They're always on the ball.
So can you give me specifics on what you're doing in terms of that coordination with other countries?
Well, as you've mentioned, we are already having discussions with other world leaders and making sure that as we are dealing with the challenges that we are facing right now, that we are also looking at long-term strategies on how we can globally work together to address this issue, whether it be migrants coming into the United States or going into other countries. This is something that we all have to be thoughtful about and all work together to address the challenges. And also, again, remembering that many of these people may not necessarily receive asylum in the United States, but also being very thoughtful that these are families, these are women, these are children.
So what are they doing? They're having discussions about strategies we can globally address and then work together thoughtfully. Wow.
Wow. That's...
This is again, these generic, this generic cant you hear from people who don't know what they're doing. They have no answer because they can't defend the consequences of their dogma. That's really what this is. Our dogma doesn't work in the real world. We're not going to relent on our dogma. So here's some cant to placate you.
Residents in the Bronx aren't happy. Rob Soto, I come here for peace because they're putting them right next to the beach and a park. It's huge, like 3,000 acres.
And there's a cost to policy?
Oh, then why don't they bring them to the Hamptons, he says. I don't live far from here, and the value of my house is going to go down, and this is where I go to relax and decompress.
Middle-income families, working families in big cities who are dutifully support the same old politicians and the same old sanctuary city policies and the rest of it. There are consequences. It's like listening to Eric Adams. Oh, there are consequences for the people that I choose to put in positions of power. Oh, there are consequences for the policy choices I make. What a surprise. Yeah. Welcome to adulthood.
Another man, Keisha, I came here from Puerto Rico, and he just said, when I came to this country, I paid my own fare. I didn't get anything from the government when I arrived. I got a job and provided for my family. They should make them do the same.
Yeah, well, better speak up. better start engaging and acting in furtherance of the society you would like to, in the society in which you'd like to live. I mean, civilization is on the ballot. Every election, and particularly this one, in the face of the dogma. Keisha Lance Bottoms also had this nugget to offer.
Well, the president wants to be very thoughtful about how we do it. And so you can't just bus migrants into cities and they are not prepared to receive them. But if the cities are given notification, they are able to receive the appropriate support that they need to absorb these migrants, make sure that these migrants have the opportunity to be properly notified of their court hearings, then that's a very different story than putting people on buses and airplanes and misleading them.
Really? You can't just bus people in and not notify anybody, but you can. Did you hear Harris Faulkner's report at Eagle Pass?
Yeah, I don't know.
Nobody's there? Walk through? But you can do that. You can have an open border and notify no one. I don't think the mayors and border towns are being notified by the migrants themselves, by the human traffickers that are transporting them, the coyotes and so forth. I don't think they're being notified by the Mexican government or the governments of Northern Triangle countries. So that's okay. But when it comes to creating this crisis and then having governors enlist sanctuary cities to live their values. Oh, well, this is where, hey, how about a little heads up and coordination? We need resources and this and that. Sure. Right. Their dogma being exposed. David Lansing.
Good morning. It's time, especially during this campaign season, for Republicans to take control of the language like the left do and quit pussyfooting around. On February 28, 2020, Lightfoot said, quote, "They're critical because we have said clearly we're a welcoming city. We're a sanctuary city. The Chicago Police Department will not cooperate with ICE on any immigration-related business. Now, last I checked, jumping the border is a felony. So the Republicans need to call sanctuary cities felony-enabling cities, and Lightfoot should be called a felony-enabler in this election season."
Thanks for the call, David. Tom Oswego.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. There's so many levels of stupid that's going on right now. And when I hear these politicians talk, I hear the Charlie Brown teacher, you know, just want. That's all I hear.
Right, it's can't.
They don't have a solution to anything. So they just keep talking about, well, we're talking about it and we're trying to find solutions. No, they're not. And as far as, Dan, when you talked about the populations of South and West Side still voting Democrat, that's national. For some reason, people do not understand the dangers of voting for these people and what their intentions are. The open border, this is done intentionally. This didn't just happen by, you know, some people making bad decisions.
Well, it's not.
It's all being done intentionally.
Absolutely. Thanks for calling. Yeah, it's not an accident. No, wait, what's this about an open border? It's not like they don't know. Of course they know. Of course, it's not an accident. And yes, in lieu of relenting on the dogma, what do you get? We're in conversations, constructive discussions to do things thoughtfully, and where you get the "we are the world" pap. We're going to work together, stakeholders, and thoughtfulness, and blah blah blah, blah 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 blah. It is the Charlie Brown teacher.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Dan and Amy, this latest installment of Campus Beat, the College Board the nonprofit that runs the Advanced Placement Program, those AP courses that are offered to nearly 3 million students in more than 22,000 high schools across the country, Jason Riley reports in the Wall Street Journal. Students who complete the courses take a final exam, 5-point scale. You get a 3 or higher on that 5-point scaled exam, then you get a little college credit out of it.
Yeah. Peyton went in with 15 college credits.
See, perfect.
Saves mama some money.
Yeah, I'm sure many people listening went through and have had their kids go take AP courses for that very reason.
Did you take AP courses?
I did. Yeah.
And how did you do?
I did all right. You know, got some college credit there to defray the costs of Tony Northwestern. Some obviously 3, 4, or 5, you know, some colleges get different credit.
Right.
Depending on the score and so forth. But yeah, so you get the program. So now what they're doing under political pressure, the college board with the AP exams, they're going to offer a African American studies course that would be AP eligible. And Jason Riley, if you don't know his work, you should, longtime columnist, editorial board member for the Wall Street Journal, at least he was an editorial board member, but still a columnist, black gentleman, he writes about what's happening in K-12 education, and this has only been exacerbated by the school lockdowns during COVID, of course. He cites New York Schools Chancellor David Banks. I love this observation because it's something I've said about Chicago Public Schools for a long time. New York City School Chancellor David Banks said last year 65% of his black and Hispanic students never reached proficiency on standardized tests, and then quipped, quote, "If everybody in the Department of Education went home and all the kids went to school, you could get those same results." Exactly. It's sort of like the number, the percentage of CPS freshmen who will get a college degree by the age of 25, which is barely double digits, hovers around 10-12%, latest numbers. It used to be like 6. So I'm not even sure that there's been as much progress as they're suggesting. 1 in 10, let's say, because that's a round number, and that's about the number, and it's a round number. 1 in 10 CPS freshmen will get a college degree by the age of 25, when, of course, the entire zeitgeist is about college degrees. Starting, you know, trade schools and alternatives starting to creep in, but the charge, the focus is college degrees, of course. So it's the same story. You could shut down all the schools and return the $9 billion, the $30,000 per pupil on adults that CPS spends, and you'd get, I would bet you dollars to donuts, you'll get the same or better results. That's how big a failure CPS is. And same thing to a lesser extent, New York City, per the school's chancellor there, not me, school's chancellor. Riley writes, nevertheless, the Dems, run by their teacher union bosses, they advocate for universal pre-K programs, even though studies have shown little to no evidence they improve test scores. And they're otherwise focused on the sex education that we went through, sex education, queering, quote-unquote, sex education, right, taken right from the National Education Association, the country's largest teachers union, right from their website. We talked about it the other day. And the 1619 Project incorporating that racism into the curriculum as well, and ahistorical on top of it. The latest evidence that reading, writing, and arithmetic are secondary concerns comes by way of the College Board, he writes, about their offering of the African-American Studies program as AP eligible. He looked at the website describing what the course will offer, although he noted the College Board declined to release a sample syllabus of the new course. Of course they did. Why release a syllabus? with Ibram Kendi and Robin DiAngelo's works, I'm sure, prominently featured. It's certainly not going to be Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams. I'll bet you dollars to donuts on that. Jason Riley, again, black man, writes, of course, there's nothing wrong with high schoolers learning about America's past treatment of blacks, from enslaving them to legally segregating them to twice electing one of them to the White House. It's all part of our history. Right, which is the position of every conservative. You're trying to blah, blah, blah. You're trying to white. The whitewashers of history are trying to project. Those who want to start American history anew today criticize people like Riley as those who are trying to rewrite American history, hardly. And he writes, if the College Board description is any guide, expect ideology to trump pedagogical concerns. The course is likely to punctuate white mistreatment of blacks in the past and uncritically cited as the only plausible explanation for social and economic inequality today, and you know, the usual. Right. Probably a pretty good insight. He notes, though, again, this is a further development down a track we've been on for a long time. People looking around and saying, what happened? How did we get here? What's going on at college? What's going on in K through 12? They're doing what? No, that can't be real.
That can't be real.
Oh,
they're not teaching sex ed to kindergartners. No, they're not.
No.
Yeah, they are.
No, they're just saying that you should be allowed to say gay. Right. That's it. You got it. You've dutifully had your brain lobotomized by the D.C. press corps. Congratulations. Pay no attention to the actual PowerPoint decks that you can download from teachers union websites. Okay. Pay no attention to that. No. What are you talking about teaching kids fisting? Oh, that's disgusting. Oh, is it? Well, if it is, then you... Okay. No, it can't be. People are incredulous. Oh. Sounds like right-wing propaganda. Oh, okay. Uh-huh. So this has been afoot for generations. Jason Riley writes... These developments have coincided with the ascendance of the progressive left. In the late 60s, under similar pressure from liberal radicals in general and black separatists in particular, the first black studies program began appearing on college campuses, and higher education has never been the same. What did that spawn? All sorts of other identitarian-oriented studies programs, women's studies and gender studies and every other racial and sexual identity studies, the balkanization, and the anti-intellectualization on higher ed that, as Andrew Sullivan said, radiates out into the culture generally because we all live on a college campus now, don't we?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA and then a quick comment.
Like the APRE program today, colleges were acting out of expediency then in the late 60s and 70s and 80s with the Black Studies program. If schools wanted a more diverse faculty and student body, it was much easier to establish Black Studies programs with weak standards than it was to incorporate blacks in established academic disciplines. The same pandering now they're doing at every level. And social promotion. What are the numbers? What are the reading and math? Forget AP. What are the reading and math proficiency numbers in CPS schools, in the system as a whole? I mean, they are shocking, or they should be. I guess we're not shocked anymore. And by the way, they're on the decline in those suburban school districts that you think are still good schools, which they're not. Most of them. Just reading and math proficiency. I'm not talking about advanced critical thinking. I'm not talking about tracking to advanced degrees in a particular substantive discipline. I'm talking about reading and math grade level proficiency. Riley notes some history you won't get from the 1619 Project, to tell you that. You know, at the time those Black Studies programs began appearing on college campuses, not well received by Black intellectuals, by Black civil rights leaders. Bayard Rustin, who was a confidant of Martin Luther King, said at the time, is Black Studies an education program or a form of ideological indoctrination? Is it designed to train qualified scholars in a significant field of intellectual inquiry, or is it hoped that its graduates will form political cadres? Finally, does it offer the possibility for better racial understanding, or is it a regression to racial separatism? He asked those questions, very prescient questions, in 1969. Well, 53 years later, you want to answer Bayard Rustin? What did it do? The Black Studies programs and everything that's followed all the way up till now, the AP folding in, the College Board folding in with the AP courses? Does it offer the possibility for better racial understanding, or is it a regression to racial separatism? What should we tell Mr. Rustin? Does it train qualified scholars in the significant field of intellectual inquiry, or is it hoped that its graduates will form political cadres? What's your answer for Mr. Rustin? Is Black Studies an education program or a form of ideological indoctrination? Anybody have an answer? He also notes, does Riley, J. Sanders Redding, the first Black faculty member at an Ivy League school, wrote in 1970, the concept Black Studies is of questionable validity as a scholarly discipline. Yeah. Conceived in frustration and bitterness by an articulate and highly emotional minority. Yeah. Some people saw what it was at the time and asked the right questions. Nobody wanted to answer them. And a lot of people still don't. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. I took the AP classes too, Dan. AP U.S. History. Got a 2. That's it. AP Euro, I got a 5. And they don't really teach AP Euro anymore. It's been kind of shunted off to the side to Eurocentric, I think. They're pushing more world history. And I'll tell you, AP U.S., I do not want to teach it. It is too document-based, and that's why I think I only got a 2. I actually learned more history when we got to keep our books in high school if we wanted, and I kept mine. I remember reading it when I was in college, and I was fascinated by all the stuff that I had missed. And that's what I think you just got to do to learn U.S. history is just read books. This document-based stuff, they've just destroyed U.S. history. It's way too much of that. And the AP U.S. class today, from what I recall from a couple years ago, they only study 8 presidents. That's it. Only 8 of them. I don't see how these kids get any breath. They may know how to parse a document a little bit, but I don't see what good that does them if you don't know your own country's history.
What 8? Really? Let's say Obama, Carter, Clinton, LBJ, FDR. I mean, I know they don't study any Republicans because to relegate them to all being white supremacists, I suppose.
No, actually, I think Reagan was in there. I think Reagan was in there.
As a good FDR. Example of the bad example, right? As an amiable dunce, right?
Yeah, LBJ, Wilson, yeah. Wilson.
Oh, Wilson, sure.
Washington. I think Jefferson and Lincoln. I think that's it. Those are your 8. It's really been completely diluted. It's anti-intellectual. And like I said, and this goes back to when we were there. You remember it, I'm sure.
Well, yeah.
Way too many documents. To study this document and analyze this. How many of these kids are going to go become historians? Like maybe 0.1% of them are actually going to go write historical books. These are the skills you need to go learn how to write historical books. And they need to learn their history, too. You can do some of that. But you need to actually get the breadth and the scope of U.S. history and know who these people are and be able to understand some themes like American exceptionalism, federal power versus states' rights, growth of executive power. Those should be the themes you should have in an AP U.S. history course.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks for the call, Frank. I think you can do both, but yeah, I mean, I agree with what you're saying, and the teachers matter too. I mean, you know, this is not piling on teachers indiscriminately. It's piling on teachers' unions and educrats and the race hustlers and the identitarian political operatives. I mean, one of the reasons I did so well in history is because, I mean, Mr. Nagus, my America Since 45 teacher, was outstanding. The American history teacher, Peter Paul at Bennett. I mean, that these guys were there forever. These were great teachers who were like super engaged in the topic and challenged your thinking and had open discussions. I mean, so the classroom environment absolutely matters too, in addition to the curriculum. But it's sort of like our conversations about police and military. The kind of teachers I'm describing, the Dan Naguses and the Peter Pauls, these are people that want to go into teaching in the environment in which what we have seen these schools become. These are not places for people who want to instill a love of learning into children. And so guess what? The children aren't learning.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and let's get right to it. Our next guest is a name that you know, a man that you followed on TV, on podcasts, and in print. Bill O'Reilly has a new book in his internationally famous, internationally popular Killing series, Killing the Legends, The Lethal Danger of Celebrity, and focuses on the lives and legacies and deaths of John Lennon, Muhammad Ali, and Elvis Presley.
But is Elvis Presley really dead?
Exactly. Maybe Bill O'Reilly will give us the dispositive evidence that Elvis is no longer with us, because that is very much in doubt. Bill O'Reilly, host of No Spin News, weeknights 5 p.m. Chicago time at BillO'Reilly.com. And again, the book Killing the Legends, the latest in the Killing series, The Lethal Danger of Celebrity. Bill, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me in, guys. Elvis is not here. I'm sorry.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, he is in the great beyond. But listen to this. Have you guys ever considered that in this country, one teenager from Tupelo, Mississippi, one person changed the entire culture in the 1950s? After World War II, Dwight Eisenhower, president, conformity ruled the day. No dissent. Everybody looked the same, sounded the same, did the same things. One kid goes on the Ed Sullivan Show, sings Hound Dog, swivels, and blows up the entire culture. That's why I wrote Killing the Legends, because people don't understand how these three guys change history in this country, history that we are living right now.
Let's stick on Elvis for a second, because last week we talked to a great and notable blues musician, Daryl Davis, who had the occasion to meet Elvis a couple of times and has played with all the greats that are from that genre of music, from the blues, which, of course, the Mississippi Delta, that was the influence on Elvis. And the importance of Elvis's childhood, you mentioned, in Tupelo, Mississippi, and the influence of black music, of the Delta blues, on Elvis's career.
Tremendous influence. If you go back and you look at the early tapes of Elvis Presley, he's clearly imitating black music from the South. But what separated him from every musician of every color was his charisma. And he was able to break through worldwide to become the most popular performer in any venue on the planet. it was almost a miracle. In fact, you know, his God-given talent is so strong. If you look at tapes of Elvis Presley and his voice and his charisma on stage, that it's just staggering. But what happened to him and Lennon and Muhammad Ali is that they lost control of their lives. Mm-hmm. And that's the thread that goes through Killing the Legends, is that celebrity crushes you. And in a lot of cases, it kills you. And I don't think people understand that.
And before we move on to the others, Elvis, too, I mean, just because this recent movie is out with Tom Hanks playing Colonel Tom Parker and the influence Colonel Tom Parker had as the manager of Elvis's life, how do you ascribe, you know, to whom do you ascribe responsibility for Elvis going off the rails in addition to Elvis? Is it mainly Tom Parker as it was sort of portrayed in that movie?
I would say Parker is a major villain, but Presley allowed it to happen. None of these guys are victims.
Right.
They allow their lives to get out of control, and that led to their demise. But, you know, I saw the movie, and the movie was all right. The kid was good who played Elvis, and Hanks, you know, he kind of does what Hanks does. But Parker was a criminal.
Yeah.
And after Elvis died, they had to go to court to get all the money that remained back into the Presley estate. His widow had to go in because Parker stole it all. But Elvis knew it. He allowed it, which is just staggering. John Lennon knew that he was being isolated by Yoko Ono. He allowed it. And Muhammad Ali had to know that Herbert Muhammad of the Nation of Islam was ripping him off, you know, every single day. And that is an intriguing part of the book. Why did these guys allow their lives to get out of control? But they did.
Yeah, but why? I mean, why?
You know, I'm not a psychiatrist.
Was it lazy or was it trust? Was it a little bit of both?
Our research shows that each of them looked away, as many human beings do, from confrontation.
Mm.
That they didn't. They became dependent on people. So the most vivid example is John Lennon. I mean, here's a guy, and these three people have a lot in common. They were not well-educated people, but they were smart. They weren't stupid people. But Lennon basically handed his entire life over to another human being, and she ran it. And he became very isolated, and he became a different kind of guy, and he became addicted to heroin.
Oh.
And that's what broke up the Beatles. And people don't know that. And was it Yoko Ono's fault? She was a user, too. I don't know whose fault it was, but I do know that at one point, he was this vibrant guy leading this band with McCartney and changing the culture again in the mid to late 1960s into sex, drugs, rock and roll, which we still have today. And the guy just disappears. And I think it's because all three of these guys, as talented as they were, and awesome talent, did not want to face the realities of life. And how many people do we all know that that's the circumstance?
Well, and part of this, too, I mean, you know, you have to, at that level, you're going to have to lean on some people to do some things for you. You just can't manage all of the moving parts of your life at that level. And so it seems like, you know, the people that that do it best, that don't fall prey to some of the temptations or failures of these individuals, have people around them that really are looking out for their best interest, people around them that are trustworthy and behave in a trustworthy fashion. And it seems like a lot of these, you know, megastars, you know, they just don't have, like, strong family influence. Elvis, at least the way it was portrayed in the movie, Elvis's dad was kind of weak. He was along for the ride. They just don't have anybody that's looking out for their interests. Truly, they're more parasitic.
Well, there's two things here. Number one, it's not easy to get good people. And number two, fame crushes individuals. The two most famous people in the United States right now are President Biden and Donald Trump. I'll submit to you that their celebrity, their fame, their power has crushed each of them in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I'm famous. I was totally unprepared for being a target for people hating me and trying to hurt me. And celebrities in the entertainment world, they don't have that kind of political component as Biden and Trump have. But they do have people basically trying to take advantage of them. They outnumber the good people 50 to 1. Mm-hmm. And if you're not a perceptive individual, then you trust people who shouldn't be trusted. All three of the cover boys on Killing the Legends were betrayed. I mean, really betrayed. And they didn't know it at the time, but a lot of the reason they didn't know it is because they didn't want to know it. And then again, how many people do we know that don't want to know?
Well, when did you realize that you were famous?
That's a good question. I would say maybe 5 years into the Fox News thing, the O'Reilly Factor. It took about 5 years for that program to become dominant in the United States. And I was working so hard, and I had been in the media for a while, and people knew me, but not at that level. And then that corresponded to the rise of the cell phone and in social media, which changed everything. I mean, Lennon and Presley and Ali didn't have to deal with that. But now the haters can be anonymous, and they can, you know, every famous person that I know, and I know a lot of them, this is a plague. Wherever they go, they're photographed, they're taped, there's people saying awful things about them, and they can't fight back. And the burden crushes people. I mean, I got a list of people. I'm not going to read the whole list, but Jimi Hendrix, River Phoenix, Kurt Cobain, Princess Diana, Heath Ledger, James Dean, Janis Joplin, John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Karen Carpenter, on, Michael Jackson, Prince, on and on and on and on. And fame is what killed them in various ways.
What about family generally or specific to the three subjects of Killing the Legends, Elvis, John Lennon, and Muhammad Ali? And I'm not talking about parents, but their spouses, their children, and the grounding effect that had, or their engagement level, how important that was?
Well, Muhammad Ali's married 4 times. Elvis marries a teenager. Lennon gets divorced from his wife, who he married fairly young, and then, as I said,
Yoko Ono
partners up with Yoko. So none of them had, on a spouse level, any kind of stability whatsoever, none of them. And so, again, and when you're a celebrity, your spouse is along for the ride. And if the ride is harrowing, that influences the spouse. I mean, I cringe every day when I see these celebrities. And Tom Brady and his wife are the latest example. Throw their pictures out into the media every day. I'm going, why are you doing that? They're going to turn on you. As soon as things get rough, you're going to get killed. But they make the same mistakes over and over. Brady's a smart guy. He's a good guy. I don't know what's going on there. But you can't take it and put it public and think that's not going to come back to bite you.
Well, the litigating it, too, like the story I saw a couple of weeks ago now where Giselle's reportedly said, I've done everything I can. I mean, that's sort of those conversations playing out on the pages of tabloids. I mean, how do you think that's going to end, right?
Yeah, it's going to end terribly, but they continue to do it. And, you know, you pick up paper every day and there's this, you know, J-Lo and Affleck. I go, what are you at? Are you blanking mind? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of this is publicists and all of that. It is a dangerous. That's why this book is The Lethal Danger of Celebrity. But it's not a book about movie stars or sports figures. It's about the American culture.
Yeah.
And it extends into politics. And you don't have a lot of people going into politics now who are good, kind people because they know they're going to get torn to pieces. so that you have a certain kind of person going in there who's willing to suffer and take that. And most human beings are not.
Well, I would also think it's a bit of a cautionary tale of to young people who, the Gen Zers, who all want to be social media influencers and put their lives on Instagram and all the other platforms.
I got two college kids, and I monitor that. And I mean, there is a strict rule. You are not to put anything personal on social media. And they don't. They know because they are my kids. And they know, you know, what I have to deal with. You know, I can't go to Wrigley and sit in the stands and watch the Cubs. I have to go, you know, into a box or, you know, this and that. And it's not that people are mean to me. They're not. 90% of the people are great. Mm-hmm. They want a picture or they want chat or whatever. And I'm happy to do it. But when everybody knows your name, like in Cheers, a few of those people might want to hurt you. Well, and that's what happened to Lennon, of course.
Right.
I mean, you can't even go up to a gate agent for JetBlue without somebody taking it out of context.
Exactly.
Because I was with you 100% on that. Like, no, you.
But
I always
that actually
go
worked
up there
in my favor.
Question.
That I, you know, and that's an excellent observation. That was one of the few times that these sneaky social media parasites actually helped America. You know, the person who did that sold that video to the Daily Mail, one of the most execrable operations on the face of the planet. But that was in April, and I just was like Paul Revere going, what the deuce is happening here? Yeah. You can't treat people like this. So I'm more than happy to take the leadership role there.
I loved it.
But that's an excellent example that anybody who's well-known, you're going to be photographed every second that you go into the public. And it's the weight of that destroys people. And certainly Lennon and Elvis and Ali were destroyed from within, people they trusted betrayed them, and from without. And you're just going to imagine it.
Bill O'Reilly, host of No Spin News, weeknights, 5 p.m. Chicago time, BillO'Reilly.com. The latest in the Killing series, Killing the Legends, The Lethal Danger of Celebrity. Bill, thanks for joining us. Best of luck with
the book. Hey, guys, always fun to talk with you. Thanks for having me in.
Yep, always a pleasure. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, addressing a couple of economic topics yesterday. He had an admonition to the owners of gas stations, but he also had some good news. Relief is on the way.
Oh, where have I heard that before?
Relief in this form, you got to listen closely to understand what the hell he's talking about.
All right.
To pay these fees, no one's sneaking surprise charges in the bills. Like Frank and I have to pay a $50 processing fee for a hotel room that you're trying to book. A processing fee. You find out later. No more hiding the price that you're paying. So now that you know what the fees are. And it's all taking money out of the pockets of average Americans. And thanks to efforts so far, three-quarters of the country's 20 largest banks are getting rid of fees for bounced checks. The average fee for bounced check is $50. They're getting rid of them. That matters. And if we do all this, we're on track to lower overdraft fees. Catch this. I know the right department's done this. But lower overdraft fees by $3 billion a year.
Wow. Overdraft fees. He's getting banks to waive $50 overdraft fees for bounced checks.
Who even writes checks anymore?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm the checkbook queen and my checkbook's empty and I'm not going to replenish it.
Well, the problem, I suppose, Mr. President, is that I don't have money in my enough money in my checking account to cover my living expenses, thus the bounce check. But hey, thanks for the relief on the overdraft fee. I can't thank you for my position where I don't have enough money in my checking account to pay for groceries and gas for my vehicle. But fear not.
What?
He also had some finger wagging in the direction of these predatory gas stations.
Oh, yeah, it's their fault.
So the companies running gas stations are setting those prices at the pump, bringing down the prices you're charging them down to reflect the cost you pay for the product. Do it now. Do it now. Not a month from now. Do it now. And it's going to save people a lot of money.
Yeah, sure. If I artificially bring down prices, boy, people could be saved a lot of money in a lot of industries, you know, if you just bring down prices regardless of cost, regardless of overhead. Bring down those prices now.
Wow.
Is that?
Like, tear down that wall.
It is. It is very much. It is. And so is that the plan? To tell companies to bring down prices regardless of cost? Pretty inspired stuff. A serious person. Deep thinker. More on this. Steve Moore joins us. Economist, author of Trumponomics, and more recently, Govzilla, How the Relentless Growth of Government is Devouring Our Economy and Our Freedom. Yeah, it was until we got the good news about those overdraft fees, Steve.
Good morning, guys. By the way, I never advertised my book, but folks should get Govzilla because I predicted exactly that this was going to. I wrote that book about 9 months ago, you know, that all this massive trillions of dollars of spending, the chickens were going to come home to roost. And folks, the chickens are coming home to roost. Now, I'm going to call Joe Biden Richard Milhouse Biden. You know why, Dan?
Price controls.
The last president who tried price controls was Richard Nixon in the early to mid 1970s. It was a complete collapse. And it didn't work, and all it did was make, you know, supply chain problems worse. So this idea that we're going to deal with the and by the way, did you notice how it's only just since Joe Biden got into office that all of a sudden we've got all these greedy companies, you know, that they've become so greedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's these 7-Elevens are just ripping us off, and these gas station owners and the credit card companies and how about the pharmaceutical companies? All of a sudden they're overcharging for drugs. Folks, this is, I've said it probably 1,000 times on your guys' show, but I want to say it again because it's a point that is, you know, no one in Washington wants to grasp this reality. The reason we have out of control inflation, the reason the Fed has to raise interest rates and crash the economy is because we've spent trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. It started, by the way, under Trump. I'm a Trump guy, but, you know, we spent $3 trillion on COVID. Then Biden comes in, spends another $5 trillion. And I love, you know, I debate my Democratic friends. Oh, well, you know, Trump spent a lot of money. It's like, okay, so Trump bankrupted the country, so that allows you to come in and bankrupt the country. I mean,
well, right.
That doesn't make any sense.
Right, when you say that Trump spent a lot of money, right, and I disagree with that. Do you disagree with Biden doing it then? Do you disagree with the printing press and the profligate spending? Or what is exactly your point? Or are we just on the program? I mean, inflation's no problem. Yes. Every industry just has to lower their prices right now, like Joe Biden admonished gas stations to do. No problem.
And it's a state of mind. Inflation is, and these are the same people who said inflation was transitory. Remember when the Biden people said it was just a high-class problem? Remember that one? Oh, it's only rich people who are really affected by inflation. Look, the bottom line is we're in an economic crisis, folks, and Amy, you guys have known me a long time. People call me a happy warrior. I'm not so happy right now. I mean, I think we're in an incredibly dangerous situation. I think you've got the equivalent of 9-year-olds, right, you know, driving a Ferrari down the middle of the highway. They have no freaking idea what they're doing. And Dan and Amy, after spending these trillions of dollars, if the economy crashed into a recession, what are they going to do next? Spend trillions and trillions more? And if I may, you know, I get so angry because the IMF this morning, the International Monetary Fund, which the United States should not provide a penny for, they admonished the British
Liz Truss
for cutting taxes. And now is, oh, my gosh, this is going to cause deficits. Wait a minute. The IMF for the last 5 years has been cheering on these trillions and trillions of stimulus spending, right? Oh, yeah, stimulate the economy. Now, you know, it's like this little tax cut, this little tiny tax cut in the U.K. Oh, my God, it's going to destroy the world economy.
Oh, well, and right. I mean, here we go again. And the Associated Press is reporting on her tax cuts as being unfunded mandates. I mean, again, because it's looking, but it just never ends. It's the same fracking conversation. Like, this has never been tried. We've never done this. We don't know what happens. Same thing with the printing press. We know exactly what happens. What's inevitable? And of course, and this is where you have people that look through the prism of government for everything. We are here to provide funding to the state. That's all we're here to do. And to the extent that funding for the state is at all imperiled, that's something that's bad policy, is not funding the state, even though, as we saw during Reagan and the seven fat years, you lower tax rates, you actually generate more revenue because of growth. But regardless, it's still their prism. That's the tell. Their prism is everything runs through the government.
And the problem is, you know, it is a global crisis right now. I mean, the global economy is in deep, deep trouble. Europe is already in recession. Japan's in recession. You know, look at the UK. You know, now I think Liz Truss, by the way, I think she's doing exactly the right thing. Cut taxes, reduce government employment. I think
she's deregulate.
Be tough. What would really cause these people to, you know, hyperventilate, as she said, oh, and also we're going to cut, you know, spending by 20%. You know, oh, my God, you can't do that. The government spending is simply out of control. And now you've got a 4% 10-year treasury bond.
Yeah.
It was, what, 1.5% when Trump left office. You got inflation running at 8%. It was 1.5% when Trump left office. I mean, these problems didn't happen by accident. It's because of incredible buffoonish policies all over the world. And Liz Truss is a date. You're right. All they want to do is grow the government, and they want to shrink the private sector because they think the reason the private sector exists is to fund government.
And then here in the United States, I mean, Biden yesterday, they have this new plan to end hunger by 2030. So they're going to expand monthly benefits to help low-income Americans buy food. They want them to seek healthy eating and physical activity, and they said it would work to expand Medicaid and Medicare access to obesity counseling and nutrition.
So now they want to govern
your fatness.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and also, you know, they're talking about this increase in hunger that's happening around the United States and around the world, and actually it is. And why is that happening? Because guess what, Ann and Amy? Guess what's happening to food prices? You know, Amy, how many times we talk about this every week about how high grocery prices are? And for low-income people, that's a really big problem. And so then the question is, well, why is there a global food shortage? And there's two things that have happened around the world that are causing catastrophic declines in agriculture output. Do you know what they are?
No.
Okay. Number one, they're dismantling energy, right?
Right.
And you need a lot of energy to grow food, right? So when energy prices go up, food production goes down and food prices go up. And the second thing they've done is the left has declared war on fertilizer. They hate fertilizer. You can't grow food without fertilizer. They tried it in Sri Lanka, and I shouldn't laugh. I mean, people are the malnutrition. Even people are starving to death in there. This is what the left does when they declare war on American energy and American fertilizer, all this stuff. If I sound enraged, I am. Their policies are killing people, and then they dare to have a conference on, gee, what do we do about hunger?
On the investment side, Morgan Stanley's chief U.S. equity strategist, Michael Wilson, said he's convinced a corporate earnings recession is coming and it could be worse than a normal recession. We think it's unavoidable to avoid an earnings recession, and that's what matters for stocks. So he goes on to say there's another risk to our earnings story, whether there's a recession or not, because you could have a situation where you don't get an employment cycle, but the earnings recession is actually worse than if you had a normal recession. You know, the market at 52-week lows this week, and perhaps more pruning is ahead of us.
It's ugly out there. It's an ugly, ugly situation. It's amazing that Biden can screw things up so radically in 20 months in office. And I agree. In fact, we just wrote that on our, you know, Committee to Unleash Prosperity hotline yesterday. There is an earnings recession that is just beginning.
And the reason, one of the reasons you can see that, by the way, Dan and Amy, is look at the difference between consumer prices, which are up 8%, and producer prices, which are up 10%. Well, that difference means, where does that difference come out of? It comes out of the earnings of the companies.
Right.
So until you bring this inflation down, you are going to see lower earnings. And as my, you and my buddy Larry Kudlow likes to say, earnings are the mother's milk of the stock market. If companies are earning, if they're not making a profit, and I'm sorry I use that dirty word. I know that's hate speech to use the word profit. Yeah. But if companies aren't earning a profit, then guess what? Your stock values don't go up, and your 401k plan gets killed, your pension fund gets killed, and your lifetime savings. I mean, look, we've seen an evaporation, like I use the word vaporization, of people's lifetime savings under Biden's policies. People have lost about 16 to 20% of their lifetime savings in 20 months.
Steve Moore, economist, author of Govzilla, How the Relentless Growth of Government is Devouring Our Economy and Our Freedom and Our 401ks. Steve Moore, thanks for joining us. As always, appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Have a great week. Take care.
You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Democracy is on the ballot on November 8th. To some extent, you have both sides suggesting that in different ways. But if it's on the ballot on November 8th, the question is, will the tally be counted accurately? The changes in the administration of elections state by state between November of 2020, and now, in advance of November 8th of 2022, where do we stand? How much confidence should we have about the results in closely contested races for Senate, for governor, congressional races around the nation? Ken Cuccinelli is national chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative, former attorney general of the state of Virginia. He joins us now to discuss. Ken, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
So we've seen a lot of action. It's hard to sort of keep track of what every state is doing. We know that 35 states and D.C. allow voters to cast absentee mail-in ballots without an excuse. 8 states automatically mail a ballot to every eligible voter, even if the voter isn't registered. But we've also seen states like Georgia and Texas tighten up the rules governing things like absentee ballot voting since 2020. So where do things stand in your opinion?
So if you compare where we are now to 2 years ago, we are really much better off. A lot of the attention in the last year and a half has been on the effort of the folks on the far left to pass a Washington takeover bill, and that didn't succeed. But while all the attention was on that, as you noted, Georgia and Texas are just the beginning of the list of states where progress was made of various degrees. And a lot of swing states, Arizona, and when you talk about having it on the ballot, Arizona has a voter ID referendum on the ballot on November 8th as well. On the opposite side of the spectrum, Michigan has what amounts to a bill like the federal one that does all sorts of terrible, unsecure, untransparent things on the ballot there as well. It even grants the vote to murderers who are in prison for murder. So that'll be interesting. I don't think it'll pass, but even some blue states and some bipartisan work has occurred in places like New Jersey and Rhode Island. They've made some transparency improvements. That's all up from the left. And then the famous or infamous Zuckerbucks, where Mark Zuckerman and his wife and Zuckerberg and his wife spent money through a so-called charity to essentially do $400 million worth of Democrat voter turnout.
Yeah.
22 states have banned that.
Good.
And a number of those states did it on a bipartisan basis, including my home state of Virginia, along with Pennsylvania, Kentucky, South Carolina. So a lot of progress really has been made, and if people just think nationally, we are in a better place than we were 2 years ago, but boy, do we still have a lot of work to do.
How was Zuckerberg able to do that in the first place? I mean, I know money talks, but that just seems so fraudulent.
Because it was lawful.
Well, look, I mean, he identified and others identified and exploited a loophole in tax-exempt law. And you know, these so-called charities aren't supposed to be involved in elections, but they are to a deep, deep degree. And, in fact, a good chunk, you hear people on the left complain about dark money, bull honky. They literally have billions of dollars that flow in dark money that will never be identified, donors never identified, through so-called charities that do voter registration, they do voter turnout, all those kinds of things, in supposedly a nonpartisan fashion. But if you do voter turnout in downtown Philly, you're getting a 90% Democrat turnout versus, say, in the sticks of Pennsylvania, where you'd get a 65% Republican turnout. Well, they spend a heck of a lot more money in Philly than they do in the sticks of Pennsylvania. But they did scatter some around the sticks of Pennsylvania, so it looked like they were doing it everywhere.
Right. Well, the other aspect of that was, and through these sort of phony C3s, was staffing election offices, public election offices, like in Wisconsin and Green Bay. They did that. And has that also been reined in?
Wisconsin was the worst.
Yeah.
It really was. I mean, you had these five mayors who really went out on their own. One of them in Green Bay is still trying to do it. But there's just look at Wisconsin. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin ruled a couple of months ago that their drop boxes that they started to employ were illegal. They're contrary to state law, and that the use of them was not allowed and won't be allowed going forward. So while there is still some Zuckerbuck test, a fight going on up there because the Republican legislature tried to get rid of Zuckerbucks, Evers, the Democrat governor, just voted along sort of the toe the party line route, as did Whitmer in Michigan, as did Wolf in Pennsylvania, where you had really the most comprehensive bill in the country proposed. And one of the problems I can tell you, having been a state legislator before I was an attorney general, is that these election codes are totally outdated. Pennsylvania is still working off a 1937 election code. I mean, there are phrases in there that don't make sense to us in 2022. And yet Evers vetoed a well-considered, well-thought-out, and not partisan bill, frankly. I mean, they were just updating the code.
Yeah, so, you mean Wolf did in Pennsylvania.
You have a situation there where their own governor, sorry to interrupt you, Dan, when their own governor was breaking the law with their drop boxes. They have drop boxes, but you can only drop one ballot off. He was videoed dropping multiple ballots off.
You're talking about Wolf in Pennsylvania.
Yes, I
yeah,
am.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You said Evers. I just wanted to make that clear.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you.
In Pennsylvania, in Georgia, what can we expect if those Senate races turn out to be as close as they currently are between Walker and Warnock, and Georgia between Oz and Fetterman in Pennsylvania? Are we going to see protracted counts or midnight sea shifts in those states this year, do you think?
So what I can tell you is in 2020, much of our side was unprepared for the problems of 2020, literally in Pennsylvania, for instance, and in Georgia, two examples, where state officials weren't obeying their own laws. And one of the phenomena that's happened in both those states, just like it did in Virginia in 2021, is that ordinary citizens by the thousands have come forward and gotten trained, and lots of us have helped them do this, recruited them and helped get them trained and so forth, to be election officials on the inside, running the poll books, reviewing the ballots as they come in where that's appropriate, doing all of those things from the inside, again, by the thousands. I'll use Virginia because I know it best. In 2021, we had about 3,500 new election officials recruited on the right and trained. And they were the ones, by the way, who spotted the problems that occurred in Virginia's elections and put a stop to it. frankly. And that's happening all over. And that's really important because without changing the laws, everybody listening to you and me right now, without changing any laws, can improve your election security by going inside and doing it yourself. And in every place in this country, they have citizens to run the elections. And historically, Democrats and left-wing groups have predominated inside, but most states have statutes that require something close to equality inside the polling places, but that's only if people from both sides show up. And our side has been deficient in that. And we proved that really works in Virginia. The Democrats got control in 2019 in Virginia, made over 60 changes to our election laws. They're terrible changes like a 45-day election, which makes it very hard to watch and makes transparency a disaster. And yet we covered over 90% of the target precincts in the problem areas in 2021 and really improved the quality of that election, playing by their rules. So the fact that Dems control the rules doesn't mean they control the outcome, and people need to understand that and go do something about it. If this is important to you, this is one of those things we talk about on the radio, you can do something about, and you should.
Just go be a poll watcher.
Be a poll watcher
is what you're saying.
Well, poll watcher is the campaign version. That's working for Fred running for Senate.
Right.
Election official is going inside and running the poll books.
Oh, being an election judge,
processing the absentee ballots. Yeah, so in your state, you may call it election judge. They're called different things in different places.
Yeah.
But lots of citizens are brought in to do that in every state, in every election.
Yeah, and it's, and you get a couple $100 to, you know, sit there for
the entire day, run it,
you know.
And meet your neighbors.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know what's going on here in Illinois, and thank God there's a lawsuit, but in Illinois, they allow mail-in ballots to be received and counted for up to 2 weeks after the election day. Are there any other states that do that besides lovely Illinois that you know of?
I can't think of anybody that goes that far after the election. There are other states that press past the election. One of the, we were talking about Pennsylvania earlier, in part because there's a couple of hot races there this year, and they've had a fight going on all year about counting unpostmarked ballots that arrive after election day. And we had this fight in Virginia. The Virginia code says you don't count those, and yet under Governor Ralph Northam in 2019, they were counting them. Well, a lawsuit was filed by public interest law firm PILF, run by Christian Adams, and they won in Virginia, and that can't happen going forward. And that's a form of security, because if you can't watch the ballots coming in, you can't have confidence in the outcome in really close races. So it is, that is one of the you all are sadly in one of the few states that's gone backwards on election security.
Yeah,
it seems like it was a form of partisan virtue signaling because, you know, how we run elections didn't used to be partisan 20 years ago. I mean, you had the Carter-Baker Commission in 2005, a lot of big shots on both sides of the aisle. Jimmy Carter, of course, leading it, found that mail-in voting was the least secure form of voting in America at that time. And that was sort of before the invention of the drop box and ballot trafficking. But ballot trafficking was an element of that. It always is with mail-in voting. And that's what they found. So this isn't just those of us on the right that have decided this is a bad idea. Before this became partisan, people on the left thought it was a bad idea too. And to that point, you look at polling on voter ID. Gosh, you know, you can't pop your head up, and I would know, without being called a racist just for supporting plain old voter ID. Try to get a tattoo or go to an R movie. But voting, who cares who shows up? And they've been calling us racist for a year and a half. Really, this goes back 20 years. Mainstream media has piled on. It's been billions of dollars. And you know what? With the American people, the needle on that issue has not moved a lick. People of every stripe think voter ID makes perfectly good sense for mail-in ballots and in person. So, you know, we do tend, particularly on the Democrat side, the Democrats who are getting elected in the last few years are much more radical. They're very Stalinist, very tyrannical. A lot of their fellow Dems are afraid of them, frankly. And we encounter that in some blue states where we get interesting coalitions
of older Democrats working with Republicans because the older Democrats are worried about these new Stalinist AOC types being willing to cheat the ends, justify the means to those folks. And they have the wheel in the Biden administration and in legislatures all across the country. And so they're not like your ordinary neighbor who happens to vote Democrat, who's, you know, otherwise a pretty normal person. I don't think they really appreciate just how far outside of election security, and it goes to other issues. We could talk about immigration and other things where these folks are just off the map.
He is,
including with their own voters.
He is former Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, National Chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative. Ken, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you both.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So a lot of has been made by this Giorgia Meloni, the incoming Italian prime minister, her quotation of Chesterton in her celebratory remarks over the weekend. The quote that she pulled was from Chesterton's Heretics, and it's this in part. So there's a longer paragraph that leads into this statement, which is important context, but I won't belabor the point. This is what she referenced. Fires will be kindled to testify that two and two make four. Swords will be drawn to prove that leaves are green in summer. We shall be left defending not only the incredible virtues and sanities of human life, but something more incredible still, this huge, impossible universe which stares us in the face. We shall fight for visible prodigies as if they were invisible. We shall look on the impossible grass in the skies with a strange courage. We shall be of those who have seen and yet have believed. Why did she reference that in connection to her more secular comments about her identity being a Christian woman and mother, family, and talking about the left as a threat to those things? What Chesterton is talking about in this passage in Heretics is the call to know truth. We don't believe in things that are untrue in order to get along, in order to increase peace. We are called to believe in things that are true, and the truth of God. And and stand in defense of the truth against those who are enemies of the truth. I think that's what she's getting at in the Chesterton citation. And I think it's an important conversation. And it should inform how we operate, not just in a political context, but how we operate in our daily lives, shouldn't it? Isn't that what you want your kids to learn in school? Isn't that what you want them to learn from you? The truth is important. And sometimes it's difficult to stand in defense of the truth, and it's unpopular, and that's when it's most important. For more on this, in part, I don't want him to, I'm not going to impose upon him to be a peace officer and philosopher, but Mike Murphy is a Chicago police captain, and part of our discussion, at least, is how he incorporates his leadership role as a Catholic in the Chicago Police Department. Captain Murphy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Dan. Thank you for having me on this morning.
So talk to us a little bit about that, how you incorporate your faith into your secular work as a police officer.
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it's not being afraid to, right? So I talk about people with a relationship with Jesus, and you know, I was born and baptized Catholic. I went to Catholic grammar schools, high schools, so on and so forth. But I never felt that, maybe 15 years ago, I had this relationship started to grow. And when you think about that, and somebody told me this, what's a relationship, right? I can't be friends with Dan Proft and never call him, right? Hmm. We can't hang out. We can't do this. So I have to have that conversation. I have to be thinking. I have to be reading. I have to pray. And a wonderful woman by the name of Lieutenant Jeannie Flynn. She's retired from Chicago Police Department. I met her when I was the over at the academy. And Jeannie was not afraid. And she talked. And she gave me courage to go out and say, like I tell the recruits when I talk to them, I say the J word, Jesus, right? Don't be afraid to use it because it's empowering. And I would have, you know, if I saw you in the hallway or if I saw you on the street, Dan, before this, and I would have felt really awkward about it, but I'm not anymore. And you know, then you have the whole separation church and state thing and everything else with me being a police department. But I don't preach the gospel to people. I tell them my experiences. I tell them my relationship and how having God in my life has changed me. And it's made a huge difference for me recently because so this is how we got involved. So I got interviewed by the Catholic Impact Networking Group, and a friend of ours, mutual friend, Anne-Marie Cronin, suggested that you and I speak because I told her about a project I've been working on. Back in June 24th, well, let's put it this way. I always say being a police officer was a difficult job, and I've been on the job 31 years now. It was a tough job before 2020, and then it became a really, really, really tough job. And myself, like a lot of officers, have been going through a hard time. And I kept praying, especially in my role as a captain in the department. I'm like, you know, I'm going to be leaving this job soon. I don't want to leave in the condition mentally that I'm in right now, feeling down about it and this hopelessness and so on and so forth, because I know it's not. And then I also said, how can I help my officers, right? What can I do for them? And sometimes you feel powerless, right? You feel like, well, I don't know. There's not a whole lot I can do. And then, Dan, God gave me the answer. And I mean this wholeheartedly because I've been praying to him. I walked out into our parking lot on June 24th, 2021. I looked over at one of our squad cars. And you know what it says on the side of our squad cars? It says, we serve and protect. And for 30 years, if somebody asked me, what does that mean? I would say, well, my protection is my service. And while that's true, those are two separate words. Those are two separate things wrapped into law enforcement. And so I started doing some thinking about protection. And if I'm living in protection my entire life, or my entire time on the job, 8-9 hours a day, what's happening to me? All right. I'm filled with stress and anxiety and those are creating my amygdala. And so I looked into the science behind this. My amygdala is adrenaline, cortisol. I have this chronic dump. And what is that doing to me? It's creating all kinds of stress. And then I went to the Mayo Clinic's website and I looked it up and it said all these health issues that are created by this. And I'm just going to read this real fast if you don't mind. It says, the long-term activation of the stress response system and the overexposure of cortisol and other stress hormones that follow can disrupt almost all our body processes. This puts us in increased risk of many health problems to include anxiety, depression, digestive problems, headaches, strokes, sleep problems, weight gain, high blood pressure, and so on. I added to this, Dan, I added through my experience, domestic issues with your families, arguments, separations, divorce. And when we feel good, when we don't feel good, we try to make ourselves feel good, right? But it's usually when you're feeling down, it's not through exercise and eating right. It's through things that aren't so healthy for us. Addictions, right? Alcoholism, drug abuse, gambling, maybe infidelity, finding outside relationships, things that cause more problems in our life. And if we keep going down that rabbit hole and we've dealt with this and we've been dealing with it, and then there's suicide. Since 2018, the Chicago Police Department's had 20 of our members die by suicide. And in a two-week period between July 2nd and July 17th, 2022, we had two officers and one sergeant die by suicide. I mean, I was literally at a roll call the one day talking to our officers
about our one officer that had committed suicide and, you know, how to take care of each other and how to reach out and our services support. And then the next day, I was talking about the sergeant that had died by suicide. So there's that. Then through my readings, I always remember this, the service. What is the service side of things? And I remember in Matthew 20, 27 through 28, says this, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be your, what, servant. In the same way, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but rather to serve and to give his life as ransom for many. So here's my Catholic values coming into this. And you're like, when are you going to get to this? All right. So how can I serve? It says serve and protect. I know, and talking to officers, because I tell every officer I come across, I give them this speech, this presentation, because I want to give them hope. And it's not all hopeless. And I said, on the protection side, I get it. I talk to you guys in uniform. You're feeling what? You're feeling handcuffed and powerless. I said, now let's talk about service. Have you ever done an act of kindness for somebody on this job? Sure. All of them. Yes, absolutely. And now, how did that make you feel? I felt good. I felt good about myself. Yeah, you did. You want to know why you felt good? Because it's biblical and scientific. Not only did it's a service written all over the Bible, but the science portion of it says when we do things that help other people, it makes us feel good. And we have dopamine and serotonin and oxytocin that are released in our body. So, Dan, what this showed me was, oh, my gosh, there's a recipe here for giving hope to our officers, because if they're coming in every day and they're just focusing on the protection thing, and that's easy to do, because when you're driving around and you got your vest on, and your police car, and your uniform, and you've got your gun on your hip, and your radio's talking about people being shot, and the whole nine yards, and shots fired, and you're running to them rather than away, that's stressful.
But do you think the policies? Sorry for interrupting. But do you think that the policies place are making their job more difficult and suicide, you know, numbers to increase? I mean, they must feel like, you know, no one has their backs and that they're under attack.
There's a lot of that. There's a lot of that. And that's the message, Amy, that I'm trying to share, is that there is a way to mitigate that. Or you can't get rid of it, right? I can't control necessarily what other people are going to do and the policies above me. If you guys ever, I'm sure you heard of Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Stephen Covey.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's circle of influence and circle of concern. That circle of influence are the is what I can do. Circle of concern is City Hall, it's policies,
right.
It's this and that. It's things I don't have direct impact over. But what I can change is what I can influence, which is me.
Well, so, how is this conversation that you have with the officers you come into contact with, how is this received sort of in both directions, those who are subordinate as well as your superiors on the job?
They love it. They all nod, they all agree, and that's what I try to do, Dan, is just basically say this. It took me 30 years to realize there's this whole service side of it. You can feel awesome about it. I have a deputy chief, Larry Snelling, wonderful man. I've been involved in different things, and I'll call Larry. Larry, I was just involved with this community event. Larry, I just did this, and that. He's like, Mike, I know you're pumped up. I can hear the difference in your voice when I talk to you day to day of when you're engaged and when you're working with people and these simple acts of kindness or service that you perform, and versus just the day-to-day, if you will, drudgery of the job. And they all like it. And they that's why I have to get the message out there, though. Dan, Amy, I have to get that message because I have to leave them with some sort of hope and come into work today and saying, like, it's stressful. I'm worried. I might lose my job. Something might happen. Something might go wrong, right? I might get hurt. But how about coming into the job also thinking, I'm going to go in there today and I'm going to do something kind. I have to be mindful of it, right? Can I give you one story, a quick story? I love this story. I was driving next to a man in traffic. I'm in my squad car. He's on a beautiful black motorcycle. And I pull up to him. I keep looking over at him on my left, and he's not looking over at me. Finally, we get to a red light. I pull the window down. I said, excuse me. He looks over me with kind of a serious look on his face, probably figuring, what's this cop going to say to me now? And I said, that is a beautiful motorcycle. This guy's face lit up so big. And you know what? I felt good. So here's the math. If I do things just for me, what happens? I'd serve myself. if I do something for Dan, Amy, for somebody else, I not only help them, but I help myself as well. So I'm just leaving them with this message of hope.
And do you get any pushback on the religious piece of the messaging? I mean, the message is really ecumenical, but you know how politicized things are. And I wonder if anybody says, hey, you know, Mike, the message of service, that's all great, but, you know, tamp down the Jesus stuff, will you?
No. And that's what's great about it. You know, again, I'm not trying to preach, right? I'm telling them it's scientific and it's biblical, right? It's there. But no, damn, I have not gotten anybody. As a matter of fact, at the academy, they started when I was there, they had a Muslim prayer service on Fridays. So Jeannie Flynn and Chaplain Joe Jackson started a Christian fellowship meeting. It's 30 minutes. The recruits come to it. And it's, yeah, you would think, oh, man, this is going to be a problem, but it's not because it's open to everybody. We're all faiths, all religions, all, you know, followings and things like that. So it's good stuff. God's working.
That is good stuff. And, I mean, what you're talking about, too, in terms of trying to improve morale, change perspective, I mean, this seems to address a real problem on the force in terms of what we hear and what people are willing to say pretty openly, that the morale in the Chicago police force right now is pretty low. Generally,
yeah, it's a challenge, and that's why I can't leave. I'm looking at going next year, and I can't leave without giving this message to as many people as I possibly can.
He is Chicago Police Captain Mike Murphy. Captain Murphy, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, and my buddy John Garrido said to say hi to both of you guys.
Oh, John Garrido. Very good. Thank you.
And God bless. Thank you for taking the time today. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.